Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is wonderful to have you here as always. Now, if you're like me, you've probably observed Amazon and thought, wow, what an incredible business. I wonder how they did it. And clearly there's work, there's effort, but beyond the work and effort, there's strategy, there's execution, there's a lot of lessons in there. And the good thing is that Jeff Bezos has been incredibly generous in sharing his thinking and outlining his strategy in his letters to shareholders. Now, my guest today, Steve Anderson, has taken those letters and has decoded them and synthesized those letters into identifying four particular growth cycles of a business, which are testing, building, accelerating, and finally scaling. And within those growth cycles, he's outlined 14 principles that underpin them. So in our conversation today with Steve, we talk about what growth looks like. We talk about risk, how much risk is too much. We talk about how to make decisions with incomplete information, not knowing what the future holds, but still being able to bet on big ideas so that you can come out on top and create a business that is truly remarkable. I believe this is a conversation that anyone who's looking to grow the business, scale the business, really needs to tune into because, let's face it, Jeff Bezos has done this perhaps better than anyone else. And as the saying says, success leaves clues. And thankfully, our guest today, Steve Anderson, has picked up those clues, digested those clues, and produced a wonderful system to outline those stages. So I hope you've got a pen and paper handy because there's some absolute pearls of wisdom that come out of this conversation. I know you're going to love it. And for now, let's get into this conversation with Steve. Steve Anderson, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us. How are you today?
I am great, Jesse. Thank you for having me.
Steve, you're really well known for your wonderful book called The Bezos Letters, which we're going to dive into and explore what is it about Jeff Bezos that's so fascinating and how he's been able to build Amazon into the business that it is. But I'm also deeply curious about your background. You've spent 35 plus years helping insurance industry understand themselves around technology, understand risk management, all those other sorts of things. How did you find your way into that line of work? And then, of course, how did you transition from all of that into the entrepreneurial space?
Yeah. So I literally stumbled into the insurance business. I was going to help my father-in-law who ran an insurance agency in Washington, D.C. and I had a stroke and I was going to go in for a couple of years and help him and then move on to something else and decided I liked it. And so spent that kind of first part of my career selling insurance, working in operations internally and those kinds of things. That developed an interest in the technology, so bringing computers in and all the website and social and right, all those kinds of things. So 25 years ago, I left direct sales in the industry and started my own firm doing research, writing, speaking, consulting around the emerging technology. So this was in 99, that lots of stuff coming and helping the industry better understand what it is and how to use it to increase sales or reduce expenses. And one of the, you know, the kind of what led to the book is one of the questions I started exploring probably 5-6 years ago now was this idea that technology was continuing to develop rapidly, in fact, more rapidly. And I started asking the question, is the biggest risk a business faces actually not taking enough risk, right? Mm. Which is very counterintuitive coming out of the risk management insurance where, you know, our whole purpose was to help mitigate risk or protect and provide financial resources if something should happen. But there's more risk besides getting injured or being in a car wreck or, you know, those kinds of things. There's business risk too. And I looked at technology and realized that those that weren't willing to keep up with it were actually worse off than those who would embrace it. But that also meant you got to try some stuff that doesn't work, right? Mm. So that started that thought process.
It's really interesting, actually. The Australian Open's being played at the moment, and this is going to sound like an unusual segue, but
okay,
but just bear with me.
I will.
And you know, one of the things that I have observed watching tennis players is you don't win a game by trying not to lose. You've got to hit for the lines. You've got to be able to push the margins. You've got to be able to hit for the lines to open up the court, or in other words, push things to open up other opportunities. And what I'm hearing you say is one of the biggest risks is not playing hard enough or not hitting for the line enough to open up those opportunities, and therefore
correct,
always being kind of at the effect of others.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And as I explored that question, there were some now pretty well-known companies who had not done that well. Mm. So Kodak, BlackBerry, Blockbuster, Sears here in the US, you know, lots of companies who literally at one time were at the forefront. And unfortunately, again, one of the things that I realized is one of the biggest risks a business faces is their success, because there's this natural tendency to protect what got you there, not look at the future and continue to experiment to figure out what's next. That certainly was one of Kodak's issues and BlackBerry, frankly. So, and so kind of looking at that side, but then also looking for companies that had done it well. And that's where I came across Amazon, obviously a successful company. You know, we can talk about that. But what was sort of different is I came across the letters to shareholders that Jeff Bezos started writing when they became a public company in 1997. Mm. And I realized that there was a treasure trove of advice and wisdom in those letters. And I think that's one of the things that is unique about Bezos. And there may be other examples, but at least for me, that was unique in his willingness to share that information and talk about it. And I mean, literally, I read through, at the time there were 20 letters, and I read through every one of them in order over a few days and started seeing patterns and the way he thought about business. And he, I would say, is a very counterintuitive business person. And I think that's where his brilliance may lie.
So he is a fascinating character, and I wanted to ask you particularly, what is it about Jeff Bezos in your mind that separates him from people like Elon Musk, Richard Branson, Bill Gates, and other very well-known entrepreneurs? Mm-hmm. What is it about Bezos that captivates your attention?
Well, honestly, I'm a space buff like he is.
Yep.
And so a little known fact I will give you that he actually had a bit part in a Star Trek episode.
Did he really?
Yeah, you can't. He's
he's all dressed up
in an alien costume. You'd have no idea it was him if you didn't know it. But from a very early age, he was fascinated with space. In fact, he was valedictorian of his high school class in Miami, Florida, and his valedictorian speech was about how we needed to put manufacturing and all kinds of things into space so that the Earth could be designated as a national park and people would come visit it and preserve it as a high school senior. So
wow,
very early on, you know, I think that kind of naturally drew me to him. But I think what really, in terms of the writing, is he's an amazing storyteller. Mm. And that came out in his letters. And I think at his core, he's a teacher. You know, I mean, he likes to talk about, okay, here's how we have done this at Amazon. And that really is where the principles grew out of, is what are the things that Bezos did at Amazon that any business, regardless of size, could learn from?
Mm-hmm. So really, he is a deeply fascinating guy and clearly thinking decades well into the future.
Yes.
That thought process as a teenager, talking about, you know, getting into space and the Earth as a national park, is probably not it's not a ridiculous concept now, but back then it probably seemed, wow, this guy's quite unique. What I'm interested in around Bezos is, in preparation for today, I'm loosely familiar with his background, but I was reading a little bit about his early start to his career going through Princeton and then found his way into the corporate consulting world, Anderson and so on.
Yep.
I wanted to ask you, how do you think that experience shaped his direction with Amazon? Because unlike a Branson or an Elon Musk or whoever, they didn't really have their start in a corporate environment. And so I'm curious to understand if you think that was a factor or not, and if it was a factor, what impact did it have?
Yeah, I think it definitely was a factor. Interesting. So he graduated from Princeton. He actually went into Princeton as a physics major. And, you know, he writes about getting at what some point in his physics career, right, learning, getting to quantum mechanics. And he said that the best thing Princeton taught him is what he wasn't smart enough to be a physicist.
Wow.
And so he pivoted to computer science. So that's sort of kind of the where the that background started. And then he ended up in New York at a hedge fund operator, you know, there, very analytic kind of place. And his mind was very much an analytic in terms of how he looked at Amazon and growth and all kinds of things. So that was, I think, really important. And I'll even point to, you know, one of my principles is apply long-term thinking. And one of the things that he almost single-handedly did with Amazon when they went public is he said in that very first letter, we will make decisions based on long-term issues or profitability and shareholder value. And he ignored Wall Street's quarterly earnings stuff for years and years and years, and frankly got away with it, surprisingly so. You know, so there are, I think, a couple things there. He understood the mechanics of the finance stuff from his background there, so he knew what the important indicators were, and he stuck to those at Amazon. In fact, in an early letter, I think it was 2004, the entire letter is about the importance of free cash flow as a financial metric, not gap accounting and other things. And they still to this day report both because they have to report the gap accounting, right? Regulatory, but they've spent more time talking about free cash flow and how that's grown and those kinds of things. So I think that's an indicator again of not doing what everyone else has done. Or does.
I'm so glad that you talk about free cash flow. And I'm just going to go off on a small little tangent because in the work that we do as well, we talk a lot about free cash flow and its importance. And of course, you know, everyone knows the saying that revenue is vanity, profit is vanity, cash is king. We get that. But not many people actually measure it.
Yes.
And track it and so on. We do that. So I didn't know that Bezos was so fastidious about that. So that's a really good insight. You have touched on one of the principles around long-term thinking. And given the previous conversation we had about him thinking about the future of the planet and so on and so forth, my question is, how do you keep focused on that vision? How does he remain committed to that vision when there's the day-to-day stuff that's easy to knock you off course? How does he remain singularly focused on that?
I think it's just part of his character. And, right, so take that as a graduating high school senior, fast forward, and I was trying to do the calculations. I can't in my head, but whatever year that was, fast forward to 2000, and he very quietly didn't tell anybody, started Blue Origin, his space company, and funded it, right? He was making, obviously had some money, but he funded it. And now we're at 2021. He's still funding it, but 21 years later, it's just starting to hit its stride, if I can say it that way.
Yeah.
So I think that is a characteristic of him. And I have to say, again, his background. His grandfather had a tremendous effect on him, and I think a lot of that may come from his time spent at his grandfather's ranch in West Texas when he was a teenager. Actually, from when he was like 4 or 5 until he was 16 or 17, he spent every summer with his grandfather and grandmother at their ranch. And learned kind of that self-reliance. And if you have a project, you stick to it. And I think a whole bunch of lessons he learned there.
Yeah, fantastic. What a wonderful summer experience that would be to have yep. that. That's fantastic. Steve, you talk in your book, there's 14 elements around growth, but four stages, and you talk about testing, building, accelerating, scaling. Can we just take a macro view for a moment about sure. those four steps? And then, of course, we'll dive into some of the 14 elements around that. We've touched on one, which is long-term right. thinking. But I'm wondering if you can give me a bit of an overview of what you mean by test, build, accelerate, and scale so that we've just got that frame to focus on.
Sure. You know, I think a couple of things. One, let me say that the 14 principles each stand on their own, but they each interact with each other.
Yep.
So there's that kind of duality that goes on there. And what I realized is kind of as a way for people at least to get my concept of how the principles work together, that there really are at least four cycles, I'll say four, that every business goes through, regardless of whether you're a startup or you've been around for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that is testing. Do I have a product? If I'm an existing business, what new product do I need to be bringing on and thinking about? So I have principles around that. I test once I say, okay, it looks like this is successful. Let's build it some more. So we start building that. We see success. Then we accelerate that growth. And what can we do to keep that growth going? And then we get to scale, which is as a company gets bigger, how do I maintain that? And we'll get to this principle, but that mindset that we're still a startup. Mm. And I think what one thing people don't understand about Amazon is Bezos certainly, and his culture that he's built there is that they are still a startup with 1.3 million employees and hundreds of thousands of customers, but they still think like a startup. So how do you maintain that at scale? And that's where some of those principles come into play.
No, fantastic. I love that because, again, a lot of the dentists listening to this are interested in perhaps not building their Amazon, but taking those principles that Amazon have used to grow and, dare I say, scale their own business to create the leverage
Absolutely.
And the time and so on. So
how do you want to scale, right?
Exactly.
That's a question.
Yeah.
And it's unlikely that there is another Amazon out there right now. Who knows? I don't. But that doesn't mean there aren't some lessons to learn that you can apply even as a dentist is, do I want to scale to 14 dentists and a big practice and bring them in and oversee, or do I want to keep it just myself and a couple people and then some hygienists and et cetera? Those are all part of that decision about how do we scale.
I think that's a really good point because I think one of the misconceptions is around what scaling actually is. Mm-hmm. Scaling doesn't mean, in my mind at least, that you have to be omnipresent like Bezos, like Amazon. You don't have to have your fingers in every pie in the world
right.
to have created a scaled enterprise. So I guess for me, scaling really could mean multiple things for different people. It could mean having 14 practitioners under the one roof, like you've just said. It could be owning multiple practices around the countryside, you know, even if it's a regional domination thing. Or it could be just creating enough leverage in your own practice to have money and time in the quantities that make sense for you. I think it's a personal definition. Does that work for you?
Absolutely does. Yes.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that scale idea can get kind of pigeonholed just into getting big.
Yeah.
And that is certainly a danger of using Amazon as an example because they have gotten big, but they've gotten big in multiple businesses. Right. So that's a whole nother kind of piece of what Amazon has done is identified other opportunities through the testing, building and accelerating that now they're able to scale into multiple areas, which as the organization as a whole makes them bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And with an obsession of free cash flow as they go.
Yes.
Because growth yes. can be expensive, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, right, I mean, one of the things I've been in my mind playing around with is this idea of compound interest,
mm-hmm.
right? And I talk a little bit about it in the book, but you know, the idea is in the very beginning years, you don't see a lot of change.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get that hockey stick, all of a sudden, the compounding actually starts being really meaningful. And Amazon had that. I mean, they had 10, 15, 12 years, maybe more, of no profits because they were plowing everything back into building out their infrastructure. And again, that's long-term thinking, and there are a couple of things that go into how he was able to do that. But he set the stage in that first 1997 letter very clearly that we believe that market share is a key indicator of future success. So they needed to grow and to scale and spend all their money doing that in the early years. And now you know, look at their stock price over the last 10 years. I mean, it's the hockey stick again approach, but it wouldn't have happened without that early investment.
What I'd really like to ask you around this is the world in 1997 was very different compared to what it is today. Technology, like chalk and cheese. I remember dial-up modems.
I do too.
Yeah. And there'll be a whole group of people listening to this going, what are you talking about?
What's that?
Right. Well, yeah. That you don't know that little ding, ding, ding noise that kind of goes. But I guess the question I have for you around that is 1997, no one knew really what technology was going to do to the extent that we know now. And we don't know what's going to happen in another 20 years necessarily.
Correct. Yep.
So my question for you is this, is how do you make good decisions with incomplete information and manage the risk around that?
So that goes into a principle in the accelerate phase called generate high velocity decisions. So Bezos talks a lot about decision making at Amazon. And he describes it as fours and types. So type one decisions are, again, his words, a one-way door. They are big decisions. They're like an acquisition of a new company, or they're hard to reverse.
Yep.
And he said those decisions should be made slowly with lots of data and probably ultimately gut and intuition.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but most business decisions are not type one. They're type two. Type two decisions are reversible or two-way doors. So if we make a decision to move forward, do something, and we don't like what we see once we pass through that decision door, we can just either pivot to a different decision or turn around and just say, nope, we're not going to do that. Let's shut it down. They're not consequential in the short term, but they could be consequential in the longer term. And he said the problem is that when companies get bigger, they tend to make type two decisions with a type one process, which means they slow down their growth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the idea of a company getting bigger and bigger and having multiple layers of approval process and, you know, supervisor to department head to regional head to something like that. And he said that slows things down. And Amazon has had an amazing ability to keep those decisions that should be made by a small group of highly qualified people at that level and not force them to move up in hierarchy. And it's because failure is okay at Amazon. In fact, it's encouraged. Again, that's one of the principles in the test phase, which is encourage successful failure.
What is successful failure? Is that being able to take a lesson away from it? Is that what they would deem as successful failure?
Like and you had mentioned earlier something along the lines of acceptable failure and unacceptable failure. What I always try and make sure people understand is Amazon has an intolerance for incompetence. So it is not about not being a competent person and just doing something that didn't work. And actually, Bezos describes it as kind of two different areas. Operational failure is bad, meaning his example was, we've built whatever the 200 fulfillment centers. We know how to build a fulfillment center today. If we build a fulfillment center and it doesn't work right, that is not okay. But if we're testing a new product and it doesn't work the way we thought, what can we learn from it? And again, the example I use in the book, and I think one of the better examples, is the Amazon Fire phone. And this was Bezos' pet project.
Yes.
He headed it up, actually. So he thought the world needed a phone that was from Amazon to make it easier to shop on Amazon. Now, this was 2014.
Yeah, I remember it.
The iPhone had been out, right, 2007. Android phones were already there. Who needed another phone? Well, nobody. It ended up being. In fact, at one point, Amazon lowered the price to 99 cents and couldn't give them away. So at the end of 2014, they wrote off $178 million in development and inventory costs as a failure, shut the project down. It was gone. However, so that was a failure, one of the bigger ones.
Yep.
But 4 months after Bezos announced the Fire Phone, he got his first demonstration of a device that would sit on a table and that you could actually talk to, and it would answer you, right? What we have come to know as Alexa and the Echo hardware and Alexa, the machine learning platform. The voice processing and a whole bunch of tools, techniques that they learned with the phone, they were able to transfer into the Echo platform, and obviously a pretty big success. So he says there are lots of experiments and failures we need to go through in order to figure out what the right mix of product, user interface. And one of my favorite phrases he uses is, we invent on behalf of the customer.
Ooh, I like that. That's really cool. Love that.
And again, I think about your dentist. I mean, for me, okay, what does that mean for a dental practice? Well, what are the friction points of a patient coming in and interacting with your practice? And what can you do to invent a better way to take that friction away? I'll give you a personal example. This was just, I think last year, had some work done and had new dental insurance, and we weren't sure how much it was going to pay. And so anyway, submitted the claim. I owed some money, which I figured I would, and they didn't have a way for me to pay electronically.
What?
Now, great dentist. I know. I'm just saying.
I know. Wow.
So I don't have checks. I mean, literally, I couldn't send a check.
Yeah.
But I think too many business owners, many dental practices, too many pick your industry type, don't actually understand the way they should the customer experience with them.
They think,
oh, we're doing it great, when maybe they aren't.
I think that there's a lot of, I think that, you know, if we were to look at the customer experience and to slice it into fine slices, I think there's lots of micro frustrations, lots of micro friction points. And what you've described there is a significant one, obviously.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But even if I'm thinking about people listening to this going, well, of course, we've got electronic payments and so on and so forth. But I think if we were to be really detailed around what is our patient experience, our customer journey looking like, and we divide that into lots of little micro touch points and interactions, there would be many moments of friction, many moments of opportunity, really, to reduce that friction and to enhance that experience a great deal.
Right. I immediately think about in a medical practice, not a dental, but in a medical practice, right? It feels like every time I go, I have to fill out the same form over and over and over again, as opposed to going, here's what we have on you. Is it still accurate or update?
Any changes,
different?
Yeah.
Right? Again, a small thing, but frankly, Amazon has set the bar.
They have.
I'll say this. Think about why you buy on Amazon.com.
Well, there's a multitude of reasons. Convenience, clearly.
Yeah.
Price is another one. It's competitively priced. So convenience, competitively priced, and reliability. When you order from Amazon, it's going to turn up. And if it doesn't, I'll fix it.
Yeah, exactly. And the way I describe it is, it's easy.
Yeah.
It's just easy.
Yeah.
And what most people don't realize is Amazon have spent billions of dollars over the last 27 years making it easy so you don't even think about it.
Yeah, isn't that fantastic? So let's dive into a couple of other elements here. I did want to talk a little bit about, in that testing phase, betting on big ideas, because that ties into the successful failure piece as well.
Yes.
And having the courage to bet on big ideas. $178 million is a big idea. And I guess from our audience's perspectives, you know, big ideas might be a new location. It could be introducing new services. It could be whatever it happens to be.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you just explain or explore a little bit about what that means in Amazon's world about betting on big ideas.
It's probably best if I give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
Amazon Prime was a big idea that no one on Bezos' senior leadership team thought was a good idea.
Wow.
Because, again, back to the finance background, right, they, quote, couldn't afford. And again, this is early 2000s when e-commerce was just starting. What was the big friction point? Going to the cart and all of a sudden having a $25 shipping fee. Mm-hmm. Which now made your competitive price not as competitive.
Yep.
Right? And so people abandoned carts, et cetera. And actually, what we know as Prime today was the third iteration.
Mm.
So they experimented with different ways. Early experiments were, if you have $50 worth of stuff, then shipping is waived. Or they had a couple different experiments along those lines. And they had early indications that people bought more at one time, especially to hit that threshold, right, of free shipping.
Yes.
And Bezos started asking, what happens if we take away and just pay for shipping? So he had a gut idea based on some data that it would actually be better. People would buy more. They would come back more often. It would be better for Amazon and better for their shareholders if they actually paid for shipping. That was a betting on a big idea. They didn't know if it was going to work or not. And again, fast forward, I think the latest number here in the US, I don't know about Australia, but I think 83% of households have a Prime membership. Why? Because you're almost stupid if you don't.
Yeah, wow. That's huge market penetration.
Think huge. About it. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And now all the other stuff that you get with Prime. So shipping is sort of like, oh yeah, but now you get video and you get some books, you get music, you get, I mean, there's a whole ecosystem of stuff around a Prime membership. Because again, if we're inventing on behalf of the customer, what else might a Prime customer want as part of that?
It's a really interesting concept. And I want to just talk about the ecosystem for a moment, because I think that's a really important conversation to have. Obviously, you've spoken at books and video and so on and so forth. But can you just talk about the ecosystem as an idea? Because I love the concept of business ecosystems. It's something I think about a lot. And I look at businesses almost as networks of businesses, about how one business can support another and another and another. And you get this kind of virtuous circle, or virtuous cycle, I should say, of constant growth. How do small businesses take that concept of an ecosystem? I mean, maybe it's this more vertical integration, but how do they create that ecosystem of businesses that allows them to grow the group rather than just focus on the one thing? I'm curious to see if there's an applicability.
Let me bring in Marketplace.
Yeah.
Again, similar timing, early 2000s, and similar experimentation. They had a couple failed iterations of what we now know as Amazon Marketplace. Mm. And again, Marketplace is the third party sellers that can sign up on Amazon to sell their products on Amazon's website.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about it. Amazon opened up their most valuable real estate, which is their website, to third parties. And most businesses would say, they're my competitors. I don't want them on my site. What Amazon said, what Bezos said, again, this is another initiative he pushed. What Bezos said is, if a third party seller has a product at a better price than what we can get, then it's better for the customer. Therefore, it's ultimately better for Amazon. Now, Amazon takes a percentage of those sales as their fee, right, for access. There are a million small businesses who sell their products on Amazon's website.
Mm.
Again, you think about a crazy idea that has now become commonplace, at least for Amazon. But even today, after all this time, there are very few other e-commerce sites that have something similar.
Mm.
Walmart here in the U.S. has just started experimenting with a similar kind of process.
It's really interesting, and this is a different example, but a closely related example. Are you familiar with some software called Xero, accounting software?
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things that Xero, I think, did very, very well, and we have a competitor software here in Australia called MYOB. I'm not sure how big it is in the United States, but it'd be like Quicken or one of the others.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And MYOB was the dominant software for so long, and then Xero came along, and what they built was this lovely core piece of software. It was cloud-based when cloud-based was a new thing. And what they did, though, is they opened that software up for third-party development, which was incredibly clever. And, of course, they opened up their APIs. They did all that sort of stuff so that there'd be this army of people building these little plugins and extra features and so on and so forth, which ultimately sold the core product anyway. So you've mobilized this sales force, which is exactly what Amazon's done. You've got these individual vendors now out promoting their product and, by extension, promoting the underlying Amazon site.
Well, and that leads us really to, in the build area, the understand your flywheel principle, because that is the core idea. And very briefly, Jim Collins wrote a book published in the early 2000s called Good to Great.
Yep.
Chapter 8 is titled The Flywheel and the Doom Loop. Mm-hmm. And you might have it on your shelf somewhere. Go pull that book out. Go to Chapter 8. Just read that again. If somebody tells me what's the most important principle, first, I always say that's like asking me which of my seven grandchildren do I love best, right? But I would say
does that mean it varies on one day of the week? You get a day of the week
each? Well, yeah, that could be. That could be.
Monday is this one, Tuesday is that one.
But for Amazon, what happened is before that book was published, Bezos invited Collins to a senior leadership one-day retreat. Mm-hmm. He spent the entire day talking and teaching about the flywheel. And that senior leadership group actually sketched out Amazon's flywheel. And it's a diagram's in the book, and you can go onto Amazon's investor relations site and find an example of it too. But my whole point in saying that with our discussion is the flywheel is, again, big, heavy, hard to get started.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get those inputs going, it just almost goes on itself as long as you continue to push those inputs. Well, for Amazon, one of those inputs is more customers.
Yeah.
And third-party sellers bring more people to the website, which gets them exposed to more of Amazon stuff as well as other third-party stuff, which gives word of mouth, which brings more people, which for Amazon also gives them leverage with manufacturers to get better pricing. So kind of your point you said earlier was, and these are the customer pillars at Amazon, wide selection, low prices, and fast delivery.
Mm.
And pretty much everything points to those three. In fact, Bezos writes in one of his letters, we can't imagine a day where a customer would want less selection, higher prices, and slower delivery.
Exactly right.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
And so the flywheel is that kind of core piece. And as a dental practice, do you understand, you know, growth may be your core piece. What are the things that you need to input, you need to focus on in order to keep that flywheel going or making it go well?
Yeah.
Now, I also say this concept is the hardest to implement because it's hard to understand. It takes some real effort to figure it out for you. And what Collins identified is you have to execute well. If any one of those inputs isn't done well, the flywheel suffers and growth suffers, right? So it's kind of that catch-22 idea there, but it's an important concept.
So I want to ask you, just to change gear for a second, with Amazon, clearly it's an extraordinarily successful company. Jeff Bezos is an extraordinarily successful CEO, founder, et cetera, like they've done so many things really, really well. Have they had any near-death experiences? Anything that where they'd have a...
I would say not lately, but certainly early on.
Mm.
So interestingly, the 2000 letter, so if you remember the .com bubble burst.
I'm old enough to remember that, which is why I'm a little reluctant to dive into some of the popular things that are top of the pops today.
Yep, exactly. I'm there with you. Their stock price went, and I'd have to look up to quote exactly, but their stock price went from like $50 or $60 down to, I believe, $8.
Wow.
And he opens that shareholder letter with a single word, ouch.
Yeah.
It's been a tough year, right? Mm. It's been a tough year. But what's also interesting, again, there are some early examples of not having enough cash and some things like that. What's interesting, though, is Bezos went out to the, not capital markets, but to the, I want to say bond markets. I'm not sure that's exactly right, but he raised additional capital before the big bust. And his letter, and again, back to that free cash flow idea, his letter was all about, all of our internal numbers are saying we're positioned very well, even though the marketplace isn't valuing us based on what we see inside.
Sure.
And that's been sort of his, I would say, contentious relationship with the stock market in general. Mm. And, you know, even in that 97 letter, he was like, here's how I'm going to run Amazon. If that doesn't fit your investment philosophy, then you probably shouldn't own our stock.
Yep. Yep.
Right? I mean, so he, again, counterintuitive. Typically, a CEO would be wanting more investment, not
shunning it.
Putting it, yeah, not saying don't invest if, because this is how we're going to, this business is going to be run.
And I guess for him, though, is getting the right investment as much as anything. Of course, probably he wants investment, but he just doesn't want to have the wrong investors
right in
there feeling or expressing any dissatisfaction, distracting him potentially from his mission.
He wants to have people
who are like-minded and on that journey with him, which speaks to the strength of character of Bezos.
Mm-hmm. The way I like to phrase this is, so his affair, divorce, right, all of that came out just as we were finishing the manuscript, and I was going to write more about family man, married to the same person, right? All of this kind of stuff. Well, that kind of got changed a little bit. So even, you know, the way I describe it is, one, I'm not his judge and jury. And whether you like him or not, whether you like Amazon or not, I think there's still some things you can learn from what he's done and how Amazon has grown.
Absolutely. Everyone's personal life is their own business. And who am I to judge? I've got no idea what goes on in his marital relationship. That's his business and that of his wife. What I'm curious to understand, though, is the strength of character to stay the course, to chart that course, to chart that vision. And we've spoken a little bit about the influence of his grandfather, I beg your pardon, on the summer holidays. Mm-hmm. But what I'm curious to understand is, what are the common traits that you see amongst entrepreneurs like Bezos, like Elon Musk, like others of that nature? And of course, Elon Musk has recently just overtaken Bezos as the richest man. And of course, that could change tomorrow. But my question for you is, where does that sense of confidence, that sense of doggedness come from? Is it innate, or is it, I'm curious to understand.
Okay. So I think a couple things. I think some of it's innate. I don't want to get us off track, but I was really interested, and I think there's an article on my website, but I was really interested in listening to his testimony to Congress this last July here in the U.S. Mm. There's obviously lots of talk around antitrust and are they mm-hmm. too big and right, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. He was able to submit a statement to Congress and then had a 5 minutes for a live statement. And he spent most of his time talking about his mother and father. Jackie, his mom, was 17 when she had him.
Mm.
And as he says, when being pregnant in high school wasn't cool. And so again, story there, his biological dad was really never a part of his life. His dad, Mike Bezos, Miguel, actually came from Cuba when he was 16 with, you know, again, dollars in his pocket and made a life for himself. That's the Miami connection, and then moved to New Mexico. But again, I think between his mom and his dad, he had some great examples of you work hard, you stick to what you know, and you can be successful.
Yeah. Interesting character. Steve, you've been really fascinating as a guest today. And for those people who want to get a copy of your book, I'm going to just go out on a limb here and just say, just go and grab it. Don't think about it. Just do it. The website you can get that from is thebezosletters.com. And of course, you can find it on Amazon, not surprisingly.
And actually, in Australia, I do know it's in some bookstores. So it could be at your favorite bookseller.
It is indeed. Steve, we've covered a lot of territory. We've been uphill and down dale. And of course, we haven't even come close to really unpacking all 14 of the pillars and influences around what drives the four stages of growth there. For people that do want to find out more, obviously grab the book. Where else would people do well to go and visit your website itself? Any other resources we should point out to them?
I will point out on the website, there's a couple things. One, there's an assessment that actually simple, no cost, will help you get a sense of your risk tolerance or your risk level, and then what principles might work best for you to start thinking about. 14's a lot, I know that. And so finding the ones that resonate with you first and going from there. There's also a workbook and some other material that kind of will help you work through the book and the principles, et cetera.
Fantastic. Well, ladies and gents, if you've taken some absolute pearls of wisdom away from this podcast, and I'm guaranteeing that you will have, head across and grab the book. As Molly Meldrum would say, do yourself a favor, grab the book, grab the workbook, do the quiz, and get stuck into it, because I think there's some absolute gems there that we can learn from Jeff Bezos, the way he's run Amazon. And of course, what I really like about what Steve's done is he's done the hard work for us. He's decoded the letters. He's brought it down into actionable processes and steps. So, mate, from all of us here, I really just want to say thank you for doing the work, for putting it all together. And I really just want to say thank you for sharing your insights and wisdom tonight on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Jesse. I just enjoyed our conversation a lot.
Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.